Welcome to the Bringing Rural Back podcast, where we help you live a more prepared and sustainable life today so that you can have a better tomorrow, no matter what. Excuse me. This is episode number 17, and in today's episode, we're going to be talking about selecting the homesteader's or prepper's dog. But before we do that, let's do the normal deal, you know. I'd like to encourage you to swing by the blog at theruraleconomist.com. Sign up for the newsletter. The newsletter is going to be the best way to make sure that you get everything that's going on at the Bringing Rural Back podcast and at theruraleconomist.com. That's the blog. Also, I would like to encourage you to join the Rural Economist Facebook page. I share goofy stuff. I just got done sharing something that I thought was kind of goofy. I share news and all kinds of posts by people all over the place. So it's a good place to kind of see a little bit extra, more than even I share on the blog and in the newsletter. The only problem with that is a lot of times people don't get to see it, so that's a bit of an issue sometimes. But before we get into our main topic, we have our first rural roundtable answer. Today's expert is Sean Mitzel with the Courageous Life podcast, and I think he's got an answer about living fences. So we're going to let Sean answer that for you.
Hey, this is Sean Mitzel here, and I've got a question, and I'm going to go ahead and read it. It says, I am interested in creating a fruit tree fence. Everything I have read has been different varieties of the same fruit. My question is, can you do this with other fruits? As an example, can you use an apple and a pear in the same fence and graft them together to create a continuous fence? This is an excellent question, and this is related to living fences. Living fences are awesome, and they're something that we're experimenting with here on our perma farm. The first question, though, to ask is, what types of functions are you looking to obtain from your living fence? Now, the question here was specific to fruit trees. And of course, we can use fruit trees for a living fence. And in fact, we have an espaliered fruit tree fence here. We have four different cultivars of apple along a fence line. Then we also have some Osage orange planted for a living fence. But again, you go back to the functions of a living fence. So the question was about fruit trees. Are they trying to keep animals in, keep animals out? Of course, fruit trees are a great browse for different types of animals, so that might not work. But is it a security hedge? Is it just to attract beneficial insects? Is it to provide as a windbreak? You know, all these types of things you have to keep in mind, because living fences can do all those things. They're great. They can help attract wildlife, attract small game if you want to hunt on your property. They can attract beneficial insects. They can keep the different zones of your property, say a pasture and a garden, separated. They can help keep animals in or out, etc. Now, specific to the question here about pears and apples, and can we graft them together along the tree? Now, the question wasn't very clear as far as did the questioner mean taking the same rootstock and grafting both apple and pear onto the same rootstock. I'm not sure. It wasn't clear. But we don't want to do that. Okay, we need to have compatible rootstock with the cultivar that you've grafted onto that. Okay, so in other words, you can graft many different varieties of apple onto a rootstock that is compatible with apple. Okay, not a problem. So, like I said, we have four different cultivars of apple on our grafted fruit trees on an espaliered fence. So no, we can't graft both apple and pear onto the same rootstock. Now, people have experimented with this, and they've gotten their apple and pear to survive for a while, but I am not aware of anybody being able to successfully do that over and over again. Now, there are also examples out there of people doing crazy things like 40 different fruit varieties on the same tree. But again, all of those fruit varieties are compatible with that rootstock. So that's the first thing. Secondly, well, sure, of course you can have different types of fruits to be part of your living fence. Yes. So you could plant your, you know, a pear tree next to an apple tree and then graft different varieties onto those compatible rootstocks. So you could get really creative and have multiple cultivars of apple and multiple cultivars of pear all in the same tree. I think an interesting idea is to almost make a linear food forest as your living fence. Okay, so you can take apple and pear and create different cultivars, but you can add in Siberian pea shrub and autumn olive and Osage orange and all these different other beneficials that all kind of work together. Because obviously your deciduous trees they're going to drop all their leaves and everything else. And if you're trying to use this as kind of a windbreak, if you intermix this with things like Osage orange and Oregon grape, for example, you can get some of that effect still if that's what you're looking for. There's also some security benefits as well if that's what you're talking about. If you're just again trying to keep maybe keep predators from trying to get in that area, or at least making it a little bit harder for them. You can use black locust, any type of locust, hawthorns for living fences. All these things could be worked together. That's what I would recommend. I would put in some nitrogen fixers in there along with your apple and your pear to make a truly, really good living fence that's going to have provide multiple functions, multiple benefits for you, and lots of really good production. This is Sean Mitzel with the Courageous Life Podcast. We are also out here on Sovereign Sunrise Permafarm, sovereignsunrise.com, and thecourageouslifepodcast.com. Thanks.
Sean did an excellent job there, and I just want to add a little bit to it. What the writer was asking about grafting a pear into like an apple tree is called a multigraft. There's several names for it, but that's just one of them. They have successfully multigraft several varieties. They go by names like the fruit salad tree, fruit cocktail tree, 4-in-1, 2-in-1, well, anyway, you get the picture. The fruit cocktail tree or the fruit salad tree has like peaches, apricots, nectarines, and certain varieties of plum. And they're actually quite successful. Reason being, they're all stone fruits. Now, you would think that since apples and pears are both pomace fruits, that they would be able to be successful as well. But as Sean stated, there have not been a successful grafting of those two fruits together. Now, you can get 4 and 5 different varieties of apples on the same tree. That's not a problem. There are some benefits and there are some drawbacks to these multi-graft trees. One is that if you have a graft break off, you've quite possibly lost a complete variety of fruit. That's the biggest problem. The biggest benefit is that if you are limited on space, you can actually get a wide variety of fruits from a single rootstock. Now, onto the living fence or the fruit tree fence, what happens is there's two different kinds. There's the ones that where they're planted, they're allowed to grow like normal, but they're planted at a much closer spacing so that their branches interconnect and they just kind of create like a wall of tree or hedgerow or whatever. There is another that is designed to actually look more like a fence. Now, if you do a search for a fruit tree fence online, especially on Pinterest, you can see that there are some really wild designs. You can do almost anything that you want. But if you're trying to make a true fence, then you're going to have some type of training mechanism. It's normally like fence posts and wire. You're going to place your fruit trees closer together. They're going to be, you know, 6 or 8 foot centers at most. And you're going to prune all of the branches that go forward and back and leave the branches that go side to side. And you're going to train them onto these wires to run more horizontal. If you're trying to make like a something that looks like a rail fence. There are some of these that where they actually graft the branches together in the center of the two trees. Now what that does is that allows each branch to be fed by more than one rootstock, more than one trunk. Problems with that are if one tree gets a disease, it can eventually run through all of the trees that are grafted together that way. Now, the next question, What typically, when this happens, they take the branches that they take off from the forward and back, and they graft it back on the tree at much lower heights than you would traditionally think to be able to create a rail-looking fence that's still alive. It's very common to see the lowest branch at 8 to 12 inches. And then they're trained along these wires to make sure that they actually grow horizontal, like I said. If you were to put in different rootstocks and then graft the branches together of, say, a pear and an apple tree, I don't see any reason why it wouldn't work. But I've not been able to find where it's been tried. It has been done many, many, many times with apples, different varieties of apples. Now, if you're wanting pear and apple and plum and all of these different things, there's no reason why you couldn't have the branch go at a slightly different height or have it overlap and then prune it. Now, one thing about it is a fruit tree fence is a high maintenance endeavor, but it does allow you to create a fence and get production from something that ordinarily would produce nothing other than, you know, keeping people out. So, Sean did a great job. I just wanted to add that. That's my 2 cents on that deal. Like he's working on using living fence. I'm working on designing a living fence. So it is a way to get production out of something that ordinarily you would have none. So now let's get on to our main topic. I know we took up a good bit of time on that, but I really wanted to go into that and cover that for that reader. We're talking about selecting the homestead or prepper's dog. Now, before I get started, I want to talk just a little bit about my qualifications. I was a professional dog trainer for over 8 years. I trained the performance sports in AKC. I trained companion dogs. I've been the monkey in the bite suit. My current dog is a German Shepherd, And if we were to add all of his AKC titles, it would be something along these lines. UD, CDX, CD, NA, NAJ, OA, OAJ, AX, AXJ, yada, 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 yada. Now, what that means is that he competed in formal obedience, he competed in agility, he competed in rally, which is it's another sport. He competed, well, he trained in tracking and herding, and I have done protection dog work as well. So, you know, I am qualified to talk about it. I have helped train dogs and owners ranging from Chihuahua mixes all the way to Great Danes, and trained people all the way from preteens up to senior citizens. So one of the things you need to consider when you're thinking about getting a dog, specifically for the homesteader or for the prepper, is the dog's personality and living conditions. And I've helped a bunch of people select a dog for their family and their application. There are, any dog can be an indoor dog. Okay, I know that there are folks out there going, no, that can't be that. No, absolutely not. I'm not having that dog in the house. Well, you know what? That's fine, dandy, whatever. I'm of the opinion that any dog can be a house dog. At one time, I had 3 German Shepherds in the house with me. And let me tell you something. German Shepherds have a nickname, German Shedders. And that's because they shed year-round. Now, we had a lot of sweeping to do and everything like that, but nobody was going to break in my house. There are certain breeds of dogs that, if they're going to be outside dogs, they have to have special considerations. Any of your really double thick, double-coated dogs can have a hard time during the summer. Any of your small, thin-coated dogs can have a really difficult time in the winter. So you have to take those into consideration. And then you have to take into consideration what you want the dog to be able to do, whether or not you're going to have the money for vet expenses, vaccinations, things like that, and feed costs. Because I'm just going to be honest with you, a Great Dane, especially while it's growing, has a much higher feed cost than a Boston Terrier. Now, the first thing that I want to talk to you about is the dog's age when you get it. Now, there's something to be said for adopting an older dog. You don't have to go through the crazy chewing up stage. You don't have to sometimes. You don't have to go through the potty training stage if it's going to be an indoor dog. But you do have to deal with the successes and failures of the previous owner. I have seen really, really, really smart dogs that have been messed up by some jackleg who didn't know what they were doing and just really, really messed up the dog. So there are some major benefits for starting with a puppy because you're starting with a clean slate. But now, like I said, there's pros and cons on both sides. When you're selecting your dog, personality is a big deal. And it doesn't matter if you're starting off with a puppy or an adult dog. But just for example, we're going to focus on selecting a puppy. The first thing I want you to do is not be in a hurry. Okay? We're coming up on Christmas. I know that everybody or a lot of people like to give a puppy for Christmas. And that's fine, okay? But don't be in a hurry. There's always puppies available for purchase or adoption unless you're bound and determined to have a puppy from a select set of bloodlines, a select mom and a select dad. You don't have to have a puppy today, okay? Next, determine the sex of the dog that you want. Is there really any reason to have one sex of dog over the other? That depends. Some females are better with children, but not always. Males are larger, they look more impressive, And if you're looking for a wow or an intimidation factor, a male's going to have the edge over the female. I have found that there is little to no difference whatsoever in the intelligence level of one sex of dog over the other, and I've actually owned both and currently still do. Okay? So you just need to look at your situation, what you want, everything like that. My wife, she likes a male dog better simply due to the intimidation factor. When I was growing up, we had bird dogs and we always had females. Females just seemed to work better in that particular bloodline, in that particular breed, but not a heck of a lot of difference. The temperament of the dog is actually the most important part. Do not get the timid puppy, shy puppy. And unless you've trained a lot of dogs, don't get the most outgoing one either. Why not the most timid? It's been my experience that the more dogs bite as a result of fear than aggression. A timid dog is way more likely to bite you during everyday life and then run when you're in danger. Timid dogs can be more difficult to train. You can run into socialization issues, even with other members of your own family. Now, why would I not suggest the most outgoing puppy? The more outgoing puppies can have dominance issues. They tend to have a very high level of confidence, and they tend to be stronger willed. And you might be thinking, that's great. That's the one I want. Come on. There's a price that comes with that high level of will. So there's a lot of breeds of dogs that if there's not a clearly defined leader in the household, they are very willing to become that leader. So it has always been my suggestion for the average dog owner to pick a dog that's in the middle, a puppy that's in the middle. Okay? Now, what that means is you want a puppy that when you go to see it, it looks at you, it plays with you, all of that stuff, and then it goes off and plays with its friends, and it's not dominating its friends, it's not trying to do whatever. That's just a good rule of thumb, okay? Now, what do you want the dog to be able to do? Preppers, their primary concern is a protection dog. I want me a protection dog. Okay? And I love a protection dog. Well-trained dog, no matter what their job is to behold. Protection dog can actually be broken down into two different dog and dog. Light of your Holifers. You have your German Shepherds, your Malinois, your Dobermans, and that, the Hall of Fame, the bite world. Now, I mean, Great Danes trained to be bite dogs. I've seen pit bulls trained to be bite dogs. I've seen several breeds. I've even seen a Jack Russell trained to be a bite dog. Okay? I really have. Training a bite dog, something you need to have professional assistance in doing. Do not get a book. Do not try to train your dog off of YouTube. Okay, please. You're going to find a lot of insurance companies will not give you homeowner's insurance if you have a trained bite dog. In fact, there's some types of insurance that won't give you homeowner's insurance if you have a breed of dog that could be considered a bite dog, even though it's been my experience that more small dogs bite than big dogs. Okay, which it reported because of the wimp factor. If you're 200 plus pound guy like I am, the last thing you do is call the cops and go, my chihuahua bit me. You don't want to do that, okay? In fact, the worst bite I ever received was from a Shih Tzu. And it surprised me, and it literally bit the nail off of my thumb and had to have bunch of shots and all this good garbage. But anyway, so that does occur. Sorry about that, guys. And that's something that you need to consider. Now, an alert dog is different. Any dog that will raise the alarm when somebody's on your property can be a protection dog of the alert type. Okay? Some of the best ones in the world are actually miniature schnauzers. They are very alert. The minute somebody knocks on the door, they'll go crazy barking, and they won't settle down until you make them settle down. And sometimes even then they won't. Okay? Any dog that will bark makes a good alert dog. Now, why would you want an alert dog over a bite dog? Okay? If you have small children in your house, if you have a lot of traffic in your house, you might want an alert dog instead of a bite dog. Most of your criminals, they want to be sneaky. And if something alerts anybody in the household that there's something going on, they're going to flee. So a lot of times a little yippy ankle biter is just as good when it comes to a break-in as a big dog, as a big shepherd. Okay, I do want to go back and cover one more thing about the bite dog. One of the reasons that I don't want you to try to train a bite dog if you've never done so without professional assistance is a well-trained bite dog is completely trustworthy with an army of six-year-olds, all of them holding plastic bats, and a nightmare to anyone who would try to harm you or when given the command. An improperly trained bite dog can be really dangerous. Do you really want to have to try to explain to a friend or family member that someone has been maimed or has died because the dog that you trained did it and you didn't have professional assistance? Okay? Now, the third type of protection dog is a general grounds protection. This can be any dog. Any dog that is territorial can make an excellent grounds protection dog. Now, what a grounds protection dog is a dog that whenever it sees anything that doesn't belong on your property, that will bark and tear out after it. Okay? If you're in an area where you have a lot of coyotes or a lot of dogs, a small may not be the answer. I have seen small dogs that have been attacked by coyotes. But then again, I've seen great big dogs that would stand against a big dog and take off running from a small dog. So, you know, you kind of have to look at your area and everything like that. You can use the underground fencing, the wires. You can use the wireless fencing that has a transmitter that's connected to a collar. You can use a regular fence, or you can actually train your dog to stay in your yard. Now, here's the thing about training your dog to stay in your yard without any fences. It takes a long stinking time, and it takes a lot of dedication. Less than 10% of the people that I help train their dogs had the wherewithal to actually accomplish training their dog to stay in their yard without some type of electronic or physical assistance. Okay? So, just realize that. The next thing we're going to talk about is livestock dogs. Once again, livestock dogs can be divided up into different groups. There are herders, drovers, and livestock guard dogs. We're not going to focus on a drover a whole lot. A drover, the most common drover that comes automatically to my mind is actually a corgi. Okay. Now you're thinking, a corgi is a working dog? Yep, sure was. Corgis were originally bred to keep your neighbor's cows out of your garden. They're small, compact, could nip at the cow's heels, and they're small enough that if the cow kicked, most of the time the hoof would go over their head. They were simply bred to run off critters. But they're a livestock dog. Okay? Livestock guard dog. These are the ones that are the favorite of the homesteader right now. Pyrenees, Anatolian Shepherds, Kuvas, there's several. These dogs live with the livestock. The livestock actually becomes a part of their pack. They become responsible for the well-being of the animals put in their charge. Some of them have a natural disposition to it, but it still requires a little bit of training. This is something that, yes, you can train using YouTube. You can train, you know, with a book. It's not going to be that big a deal. It's pretty easy to do. Though I have known a Pyrenees, a young dog, young male, he was so protective of his goats that when a mama had a baby, he wouldn't let the baby get up and get around, and the owner had to go out there and get on to him because he was so worried over the baby that he wasn't allowing the baby to get up and move around. He was protecting the baby. So that does occur. He didn't, you know, there was no tooth that ever laid hands, that ever laid on the kid, but he would just keep pushing the baby back down with his head because he felt like, I don't know what he thought, but he thought it was sick or something like that. Now, a herding dog is completely different, even though you'd think they're related to the livestock guard dog. The livestock guard dog lives with the livestock. The herding dog lives with the livestock owner. The herding dog's primary objective, yes, it does help protect the flock, but its primary objective is to help the owner move the livestock. Okay? Australian Shepherds, Australian Cattle Dogs, German Shepherds, Bouviers, Kelpies, and several mixes. Incredible, incredible working dogs. I've seen some that just seemed like they had it naturally, and then I've seen some that didn't at all. The only time that I saw a dog kill a sheep was a Bouvier, and a Bouvier is a French herding dog, and I've seen some that worked really good, but this one, it went crazy, and it killed a sheep. And the sheep owner wasn't real happy, and the dog owner wasn't real happy. But, you know, they help you move the sheep. This is another area. YouTube, books, videos, great. Some of them are excellent training tools. So don't be afraid to step out there on your own and train this type of dog. I've helped train border collies. I've helped train shepherds. I've helped train kelpies. If at all possible, find somebody in your area with an active working dog, even if you're training with videos or YouTube or whatever. That way, if you run into problems, there's somebody you can ask questions. Some areas, I know that's not an option. Join some of the herding dog forums. They are out there. They're kind of hard to find sometimes, but they are out there. So, this is, training these dogs, herding dogs, is really rewarding. I cannot tell you how good it feels to be able to whistle to a dog and have them take 7 sheep and put them in a pen, and you're standing on the corner, leaned up against a fence post. That is one incredible feeling. So, there are several other jobs that dogs can do. Hunting dogs. When I was growing up, we always had an English pointer, liver spot to be exact. And like I said earlier, we never had a male pointer. We always had females. My grandfather just liked them better. He said they worked better. Now, I've had blue tick hound coon dogs, and I can tell you that it depends on the dog. Because I had some really, really good working males, and then I had some really stupid males, and then I had some really good working females and some really stupid females. So, it's not that, you know, it's not sex-linked. So, you just going to have to work with whatever you get. There are retrievers, there's pointers, there's setters, there's all of these different ones. Again, if you've never gotten to hunt over a bird dog and watch them point quail or pheasant or whatever it is, and then them flush and then take the shot, it fall, and them come and bring you that bird and lay it right in your hand, or you've never gotten to duck hunt with a good lab, that as soon as it falls, you give it the release word, and it goes out there, and you can direct that dog right where that duck fell, and he'll bring it right back, or she'll bring it right back to you. That's really cool. I mean, it really is. All right. Now, there's draft and pack dogs. You don't see this a whole lot. But at one time, draft dogs were very common, especially in the United States. And a lot of the Native Americans before the Spanish brought the horse over utilized dogs as pack animals and draft animals. Now, if I'm going on a long camping spree, I've done this in the past, my dog, he's pretty old now, but he had a set of saddlebags that we would pack up with at least everything that he needed for the camping trip, and he would carry his own gear. Now, did it help a whole lot? Maybe not, but it did relieve me from having to carry everything that was necessary for his well-being. So, every little bit helps. Next is a companion. Just simply a companion. A lot of people don't realize that most of the lap dogs actually started off as flea catchers. Now, what do I mean by a flea catcher? When the fancy people, the rich ladies and the rich men would sit around or sleep with their little fluffy dog, they were doing it so that the fleas would leave the person and go to the dog. And then the servants the next day would bathe the dog and pick off all the fleas and kill the fleas. So they actually had a purpose other than being frou-frou. Companion dogs help relieve stress. They can make your life better. And they can still be an alert dog, okay? The final one I want to cover is rodent control. All of your terriers were actually bred to be rodent control. In the old world, they would actually have like rat terriers, miniature schnauzers, things like that, which would live in the warehouses, and their job was to keep the rat population down. That was part of their job. And let me tell you something, some of them are good at it. There is a sport that's actually designed around anything that goes to ground. By going to ground, you know, you're talking about and rabbits and nowadays armadillos and everything like that. They'll really, really get after it. So if you have a rodent problem and you don't like cats or whatever, then a terrier may be a good bet for you. So we've talked about several breeds. We've talked about several different jobs. We've talked about temperament. We've talked about all that. So now let's talk about obtaining your dog and choosing your dog. If you have decided that you want to go with a purebred dog, do your research. But here's the thing. Every breed book is written by somebody who is dedicated to and loves that breed. They're going to be as honest as they can but they're going to hedge their bets. They're not going to want to badmouth their breed. Now, the only one that I've seen that was completely honest was a book several years ago about Jack Russells. Because the opening sentence of that book was, Jack Russells are not for everyone. And then they went in and told all the problems. But in general, that doesn't occur. So there's some key words that I want you to look at when you're reading a breed book about some possible behavioral problems. High spirit. That equals needs a lot of exercise or will become destructive. Energetic, same as above. Okay? Independent, really doesn't care whether or not you're there. Aloof, going to do what I want to do unless I have a really strong leader. Okay? Focused. When something has its attention, the world could explode and it wouldn't notice. So I want you to put your critical thinking cap on whenever you're reading a breed book. They don't mean to be deceiving, but they are dedicated to their breed. So, you've decided to adopt. Let's just say that. Okay. Now, there is a animal shelter not far from where I am that they regularly have purebred dogs in the animal shelter. In 1 year, they had 17 purebred German Shepherds. They had, I don't know how many labs and everything else. I mean, if you're willing to take your time, and if it's a county shelter, if it's not overly busy, I know some of the smaller shelters, all of the ones that I've ever dealt with, if you're looking for a specific breed, then you can leave your name and number, and if one comes in, they will call you. They always did me. Okay? Look for mixed breeds, though. Mixed breeds tend to not have all the health problems that a purebred does. A lot of your larger breeds, even the mixed breeds, can have hip dysplasia problems. Certain bloodlines and breeds of dogs are more prone to certain cancers. Definitely look that up when you're doing your breed research. So, you know, be willing to allow adoption to be an option. Okay? So, let's say you decided you want a puppy. All right. You've got to decide whether or not you care whether or not it's registered. Now, in the United States, the AKC is kind of king, the American Kennel Club. Last time I looked, and I've been inactive with the AKC for a few years now, there was 187 breeds, I want to say. Okay, that's still a lot of breeds. They keep meticulous records. If you get a dog that has an AKC registration, you know what you're getting. Next one is UKC, United Kennel Club. They're the second oldest kennel club in the United States. Very reputable. 400 and something breeds. They're more international. And great. Absolutely fine. Okay? Now, CKC. And I'm not talking about Canadian Kennel Club. The Canadian Kennel Club's great. I'm talking about Continental Kennel Club. Continental Kennel Club, is it a breed registry? Yes, it is. Is it reputable? Anybody can register any dog in the CKC. At one time, now I haven't researched this recently, at one time, if I said that something was a Labrador, and I'm the owner, and I got two more people to say it was a Labrador, I could register it as a Labrador. Okay? There was rumors of somebody getting a goat registered as a dog. Now, I've never verified that. Don't care. But it's not worth it to me with all the questions. If I'm going to get a registered dog, and it's not near as important to me now as it used to be, I'm going to go UKC, AKC, or Canadian Kennel Club. Because Canadian Kennel Club automatically is recognized by both the UKC and AKC. Okay? So that's something that I want you to consider. Well, that's about it. I hope you enjoyed this. I'd love to hear your stories about your dog. I'd love to hear about your adoption. I'd love to hear about the jobs that they do around your homestead or around your pepper place. So, I want you to remind you about the Rural Roundtable. We had our first answer today. I want to remind you about the Facebook page, the newsletter on the blog. And if you enjoyed this, if you enjoy what we're doing, share it. Share it on social media. Send it to somebody on email. Go, hey, man, listen to this. Okay? And if you enjoyed it, swing by iTunes or Stitcher and give us a rating. That's all I'm asking. Thanks. Step by step, we're bringing Rural back. Bye.